Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, I have a report on a small Mexican town housing thousands of Venezuelan migrants. John Russell has a story on a new study that suggests Neanderthals formed small, close communities. Ana Mateo brings us words and their stories on the phrase, bury your head in the sand. Andrew Smith and Jill Robbins have this week's higher education report on a divisive chemistry professor at New York University. Finally, Brian Lynn has a story on a floating device that protects whales from ships. But first, migrants, especially Venezuelans, are struggling with a new United States policy meant to prevent border crossings. And many Venezuelan migrants trying to enter the U.S. are now stuck in a small town in southern Mexico. The town of San Pedro Tepanatepec had 7,000 migrants when the Associated Press visited at the beginning of October. About 75% were Venezuelans. Just weeks later, Mayor Humberto Parazales estimated the number was now 14,000. The town has a population of just 15,000. Many Venezuelans had planned to make their way to the U.S. border. But the new U.S. policy says only those applying online and arriving by air will be admitted. Border crossers by foot will be expelled. That leaves many living in Tepanatepec in five large tent shelters, wondering what they will do next. San Pedro Tepanatepec is not where the migrants wanted to be. The town is about 300 kilometers from the border with Guatemala. Since August, the town has served as a stop for migrants. They would wait there for a few days while Mexican immigration officials gave them a travel pass to make it to the U.S. border. But Parazales says the process for giving out the passes has slowed down. Now many more migrants wait in Tepanatepec, a poor town unprepared for so many people. I don't understand anything, Venezuelan migrant Robinson Rodriguez said by phone from Tepanatepec. If everything at the border is closed, then they shouldn't be handing out these passes. Nicaraguan migrant Luis Martinica showed a paper with an internet link for Venezuelans to apply. But he wondered if he, a Nicaraguan, would be expelled at the U.S. border. Mayor Parazales has his own problems. The town can no longer provide the electricity needed for the camp. Healthcare, cleaning, and water are also problems. Still, migrants are bringing in money to the town. Parazales said the town has seen about $15 million in extra business, selling migrants food, places to sleep, medicine, taxi, and bus rides. He said they pay money to charge their phones. Mexico has released about 77,000 passes to Venezuelans so far this year, mostly in the last 3 months. Because of political reasons, Venezuelans, like Cubans, are hard to expel, both for Mexico and the United States. Mexico's National Immigration Institute did not answer questions from the AP about how the camp will be operated following the new U.S. policy. There is a big lack of information, Parazales said. This is a pressure cooker I'm trying to contain here.
Study suggests Neanderthals formed small, close communities where females may have traveled to move in with their mates. The research used genetic investigation to offer an idea of Neanderthal family life, including a father and his daughter who lived in Siberia more than 50,000 years ago. Researchers were able to pull DNA out of tiny bone pieces found in two Russian caves. In their study, which appeared recently in the publication Nature, they used genetic data to map out relationships between 13 different Neanderthals and get information about how they lived. Benseviola of the University of Toronto helped write the study. When I work on a bone or two, it's very easy to forget that these are actually people with their own lives and stories, Viola said. He added, figuring out how they're related to each other really makes them much more human. The Neanderthals, our ancient relatives, lived across Europe and Asia for hundreds of thousands of years. They died out around 40,000 years ago, shortly after our species, Homo sapiens, arrived in Europe from Africa. Scientists have only recently been able to study these early humans' DNA. New Nobel Prize winner Svante Paabo, who was one of the writers of this latest study, published the first study of a Neanderthal genome more than 10 years ago. Since then, scientists have sequenced 18 Neanderthal genomes, said study lead writer Loritz Skov of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. But it is rare to find bones from multiple Neanderthals from the same time and place, he said, which is why these cave discoveries were so special. If there was ever a chance to find a Neanderthal community, this would be it, Skov said. The caves, located in hills above a river valley, have been a rich source of materials from stone tools to fossil pieces, Viola said. With their view of animals in the valley below, Neanderthals may have used the caves as a hunting stop. Researchers digging at the caves have found remains from at least 12 different Neanderthals, Viola said. These remains usually come in small bits and pieces, a finger bone here, a tooth there, but they're enough for scientists to get valuable DNA details. The researchers were able to identify a couple of relatives among the group. Along with the father and daughter, there were two other relatives. Overall, the study found that everyone in the group had a lot of DNA in common. That suggests that, at least in this area, Neanderthals lived in very small communities of 10 to 20 individuals, the authors concluded. but not everyone in these groups stayed together. Researchers looked at other genetic information from mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down on the mother's side, and the Y chromosome, which is passed down on the father's side. The female side showed more genetic differences than the male side. This suggests females may have moved around more, Skov said. It is possible that when a female Neanderthal found a mate, she would leave home to live with his family. University of Wisconsin anthropologist John Hawks, who was not involved in the study, said the research was an exciting use of ancient DNA evidence, even as many questions remain about Neanderthal social structures and lifestyles. Figuring out how early humans lived is like putting together a puzzle where we have many, many missing pieces, Hawks said. But this study means there are more pieces on the table. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we dive into words and expressions in the English language. We go beneath the surface of an expression and explain it more fully. We give examples, notes on usage, and sometimes we tell where the expression came from. Today we talk about avoiding difficult subjects. One way you can do this is to bury your head in the sand. Burying your head in the sand means that you are avoiding, or trying to avoid, a situation. You do this by pretending that it does not exist. Some word experts say this expression comes from a common but mistaken belief about a large flightless bird. Some believe that ostriches bury their heads in the sand when frightened. The idea is that an ostrich believes that if it cannot see any danger, the danger is not there. Experts say the birds do not really do or think this. They do, however, dig a lot in the sand for food, but not to avoid danger. But you can use the expression, bury your head in the sand, to describe people who refuse to think about unpleasant but important facts. You can use it for those who hide or ignore clear signs of danger. These types of people are all burying their heads in the sand. The expression means the same if you drop the word bury and just say someone has their head in the sand. The expression can also be used as an adjective. A head-in-the-sand approach, attitude, opinion, or method refuses to recognize a problem, and they will probably not be very effective. For example, the teacher had a head-in-the-sand idea of her students, She did not see that they were not understanding her classes. Organizations can be described as head in the sand. So can people. Now, let's hear two friends use the expression to bury your head in the sand.
The storm clouds are starting to move in. We should get going. Have you packed your emergency bag?
No, I'm not leaving.
What? What do you mean? There is a Class 5 hurricane coming. The whole city is being evacuated.
I've been through hurricanes before. I'm going to ride out the storm in my apartment.
Look, now is not the time to bury your head in the sand. This is serious. Even if nothing happens to this apartment building, food and water will be hard to find. Electricity will go out.
It'll be fine.
No, it won't. Now get your head out of the sand, pack a bag, and come with me.
And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Maitland Jones, a well-known organic chemistry professor at New York University, NYU, was fired over the summer. The 84-year-old professor wrote a famous book, Organic Chemistry, which is still used in many college classes. He taught the class for many years at Princeton University before retiring in 2007. Since then, he taught the subject at NYU on a series of one-year contracts. The New York Times reported recently that NYU students started an appeal against Jones. 82 students, out of 350 taking his class last spring, signed the document saying they believed he was not fairly considering their work. They were unhappy with their low grades, and they felt his teaching method made a difficult subject harder for them to learn. They also told NYU that bad grades hurt their chances of getting into medical school. The Times said that Jones defended his teaching method. In fact, he is known for starting a new teaching method that centers on problem-solving rather than remembering without thinking. He said some students were not coming to class or watching videos from the class. Jones said grades fell even as he made tests easier. He said, coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, the students not only did not study, but they also did not seem to know how to study.
Just before the start of classes in autumn, NYU decided to end Jones's contract. A spokesman said the university was evaluating all classes, including organic chemistry, in which a high percentage of students receive low grades. The school also offered to reconsider the students' low grades in Jones's class. The firing of Jones brought thousands of comments from students, former students, and professors. Some felt that Jones should have made the class easier and changed his ways of dealing with or grading students. Others supported keeping the class's demanding instruction and grading systems. Renee Link is a chemistry professor at the University of California, Irvine. She told VOA, "When you see these things, and we see these issues come up, it's easy to put it on students or on faculty, but really it's a systemic problem, and it's not any individual's fault. Like, everybody's got to share in the blame here."
Link said she uses a system known as specifications grading. The idea, she said, is to start the study term by showing students how they can prove their abilities. If they can meet the highest goals, they can get a good grade at the end of the term. Some college professors think they should limit the number of top grades given out to students. But Link said there is no limit to the number of top grades she would give out. Link said specifications grading permits students to learn at their own speed. Link said, "Students can progress at a slower speed and still show what they learned.
We can give students multiple attempts over time to demonstrate that they've learned something, without necessarily penalizing them for not having learned it when we thought they should have," Link said.
One of the concerns about Jones's class at NYU was that students felt they did not have enough chances to prove themselves. If they did poorly on a test, they argued, it would sharply affect their overall grade. Jerry Kirsteins is a chemistry professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Kirsteins wants to change the idea that some classes, called weeded out classes, are set up to prevent students from moving forward. Medical schools in the U.S. require organic chemistry. So, if a student does poorly in class, they might not have a chance to study to become a doctor.
Kirsteins told VOA, "There are two ways to think about grades." She said people understand that an A grade shows a medical school or employer that a student is prepared to work or study at a high level. Kirsteins added, "But on the flip side, grades are terrible. They are not truly representative of what students can do in many cases." She proposed that there should be a way to meet in the middle and permit students to demonstrate their abilities in a way that is fair and equitable. She also suggested having students work together on projects and having several tests during the study term so that no single test is more important. Link said she is worried that people who are not close to the teaching of chemistry may find faults with the younger generation of students. However, she is now seeing thoughtful conversations among people who teach the subject. Kirsteins said she hopes the story about Jones at NYU leads people who guide chemistry departments at universities to think about making changes. They should think about chemistry education, she said, and why they do things the way they've always been done, because that only works for some people. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Andrew Smith. Thank you.
A device floating in waters off the coast of southern Chile aims to collect data on nearby whales to protect them from passing ships. The first electronic buoy was recently placed in the sea in the Gulf of Corcovado, about 1,100 kilometers from the capital, Santiago. The device is designed to listen to the sounds whales make when they communicate with each other. The animals use sound to map their movements and to hunt. The sounds are processed by artificial intelligence, AI-powered computer systems, in an effort to identify where the animals are. This information is then sent to shipping operators to help them avoid crashing into whales. A nonprofit organization called the Blue Boat Initiative put the buoy in place. The group seeks to develop and deploy technology tools to provide a warning system for shipping companies. In addition to helping protect whales, the smart buoy also collects data on the health of the ocean and the effects of climate change. The group plans to place a series of buoys along the path whales take on trips from Antarctica to the equator. The Gulf of Corcovado is rich in sea life, including a large number of blue whales, as well as sei and southern right whales. All these whales are listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The area's whale population is largest during the summer season in the southern hemisphere. In 2008, Chile banned whaling activities, including whaling for scientific purposes. The country has established a number of protected areas for whales and other endangered species. "This is the beginning of a longer road," said Sonia Espanol, director of the Blue Boat Initiative. She noted that her team plans to cover the Gulf with at least 6 buoys. "The idea is to be able to cover the entire migratory route of the whales from Antarctica to the equator," Espanol said. The buoy works by using software called Listening to the Deep Ocean Environment. The device continuously monitors ocean sounds. It uses AI to identify the kind of whales and where they are in real time. It then sends messages to nearby ships so they can reduce noise levels and try to avoid crashes. The buoys also contain sensors to measure water temperatures, oxygen levels, and more to predict ocean health and the effects of climate change. That information is expected to be used to help guide public environmental policies. In the United States, scientists recently deployed a similar whale warning system off America's west coast. That system, called WhaleSafe, also uses buoys to identify the presence of whales. I'm Brian Lynn.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.